You're listening to Market Champions, a podcast on navigating the financial markets. Here's your host, Srivastava Prakash.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Market Champions. Today I've got Bob Elliott. Bob is the co-founder, CEO, and CIO at Unlimited Funds. He used to be part of the investment committee at Bridgewater, and he was the head of the research team over there, Ray Dalio's research team, which is amazing. So Bob Elliott, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It is awesome to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me. Looking forward to it.
Awesome. So Bob, some of the listeners who may not know, could you talk a bit about your background, how you got started? You went to Harvard, and then your journey in the finance world started from there. So could you talk a bit about your background and how you got into the industry and your journey to where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, my background is a little different than many people who are in the finance industry. I was actually a botanist by academic training. When I was in my younger years in high school and then in college, did a lot of work in the space. But over time, sort of realized that, being a research scientist wasn't really right for me. I enjoyed interacting with people more than like sitting in the biological laboratories with running big growth chambers. And I think that combined with the fact that during my college years, got increasingly interested in development-related topics and public health, and really recognizing that, macroeconomics is really, really intersects all sort of facets of life, particularly when it comes to development and health-related issues. And so I actually went to Bridgewater on the expectation that it would be sort of a short stint where I'd learn a lot about the macroeconomy and then maybe go off and do something else. But over the course of my time there, really fell in love with markets and economies and thinking about macro have stuck with it ever since. 20 years later, I'm here talking to you about macro.
There we go. And it's crazy how life takes us in interesting directions. And now, as you mentioned, macro is, it's very interesting because macro is kind of the amalgamate of so many different, you have to know some amount of economics and finance, and then you have to know some amount of game theory, some amount of complexity science, et cetera. So there's just kind of this amalgamation of so many different fields of study.
That's exactly right. And I actually think the pure sciences are such a good entry point into at least macro and economics, because, pure sciences, like what you're trying to do is you're trying to understand like systems and how they intersect with each other. In particular, my research was on like plant development and how water transport and nutrient transport systems intersected with environmental conditions. And like that in many ways is exactly how the macroeconomy works, in the sense of that there are these, somewhat independent dynamics that intersect with each other to create a certain set of outcomes. And so that science training, that rigorousness, both the balance of intuition, experimentation, and observation, frankly, the quantitative approaches were all super relevant skill set, and maybe also really a way of thinking that I think has served me well and sort of given a bit of a different perspective than having, learn some curves or something like that in a more traditional academic economic environment.
Absolutely, yeah. It gives you the chance to apply kind of the kind of systems thinking that you learn, studying the pure sciences. And when you were at Bridgewater, what was that experience like? You spend a very long time over there, Bridgewater is kind of when you read Principles by Ray Dalio, and he talks a lot about transparency, the importance of culture and the environment. So, working over there, what were kind of the biggest takeaways, your biggest takeaways, the things you learned, et cetera?
Well, I think certainly I'd say in my first decade there, working closely with Ray, I learned a lot about how to think rigorously about macro, about markets, and about how to develop systematic approaches. And I think You know, I think the couple of key sort of lessons, experiences, skills, maybe you might even say, that I learned was really a this idea of thinking from the big picture all the way down to the practical reality and all the way back up, and having to make sure that those things all intersect with each other very well. I think that's often you'll meet people who might be particularly good at the big picture or particularly good at sort of the details of analysis, and that in order to really understand how things work, you really have to work at all those levels, which is important. Push yourself to work at all those levels. I think the other thing that was really critical to develop a skill set around was this idea of systemization, which, you know, systemization, you start to talk about and people's eyes, you know, sort of glaze over and they think you're just talking about a black box scenario. And I think particularly also as people talk more about AI today, and then that's like even more black boxy, yeah, and like, what the heck is all this? And I think, it was really a great environment to develop an appreciation for the fact that there's a set of tools that are out there, like AI, machine learning, regression, whatever, all these different tools, random forest. There's a bunch of different tools that you can use that are quantitative techniques to help you express an intuitive or fundamental understanding, express and measure an intuitive and fundamental understanding. But the way that works, at least as it works for macro, is that the direction has to be from the intuitive understanding to the use of the tools to then the outcomes and then trading markets. It's very important to think in that direction. Too often I see folks who are very deeply skilled in the techniques trying to go back to the intuition, and that doesn't work. And the reason why that is particularly in macro investing is because there isn't enough sample size to be able to really operate in a way where you can sort of use the techniques to infer the understanding, because the techniques, you know, many of these techniques require a level of sample size to build their inferences that is, you know, we've had 7 macro cycles since 1945 or whatever, like that, you know, that's literally 7 data points, you know, 7 data points isn't going to get it done. And so really understanding and appreciating where are those tools effective, you know, many sort of machine learning models are very effective in, say, short-term individual security trading with a time frame of 1 day. That's a very, you know, because you have incredible sample size to infer from there, and incredible ability to bet on a lot of different outcomes, but definitely doesn't work as a solution to certain other problems, like, you know, is the yield curve inversion, does that indicate a recession? And if it does, over what time frame? Like that is, you know, not a very good use of those sorts of techniques. So a lot of that, there was a lot of building that suite of understanding and toolkit that I can then apply in a bunch of different ways, as I'm doing what I'm doing now.
So when you say, you know, you go from kind of the intuitive understanding, so would that be, for example, saying, you know, bonds are, you know, so are, you know, are safe, are kind of a safe asset, so therefore in kind of a bear market, you know, generally speaking, you know, in a bear market bonds should do well, and then after that trying to see how bonds behave in a bear
market. Right. That's a simple, I always like to say, well, you know, if inflation expectations rise relative to what people had initially expected, generally bonds will sell off. Yeah. And why is that? Because bonds, you know, the interest rate on bonds is reflective of a combination of what people expect on the real yield plus what they expect to get paid for inflation over time. And so, like, that's a fundamental, that's a sort of a simple fundamental understanding, intuitive understanding of how the world works. And then you can go back and you can say, is that simple intuitive understanding true or not true, right? Is it, you know, does it work that way, you know, in all environments, in some environments, right? And start to build that sort of, and then the question inevitably comes, okay, so I just said that, and you're like, okay, yeah, if inflation is above expectations, bonds sell off, but like, what does that actually mean in terms of how do you go execute that? How do you measure that? How do you figure out what's priced in? Like, you know, this is not a trivial exercise,
yeah,
but it starts with the intuition and then goes in that direction. And I think in particular, this environment has been really important to force people to start with the intuition and start with the fund. I'd say I call this the fundamental intuition, and then have to go and then go and measure those dynamics. And I think, like, you know, yield curve inversion, such a good example. Like, everyone, you know, how many people were like, well, the yield curve's inverted, recession is now. And it's like, hold on. Let's that's a good example of observing and inferring, you know, observing and intuiting, right? Rather than saying, okay, well, let's talk about what are the fundamental drivers, the intuitive fundamental drivers of how, you know, the macroeconomy works. And how does the yield curve fit into that? Is it a reflection of the fundamental dynamics? Is it an indicator of what's likely to transpire in certain ways? Is it a reflection of market pricing? Mm-hmm. Is it a reflection of supply and demand imbalances? Like, all of those things are the fundamentals that you have to understand. You can't just sort of use the indicator and go back and say, well, obviously this is just how it works, is, you know, recession's on the way.
Got it. Yeah, no, that's absolutely key. And, you know, as you mentioned, like, you know, there's kind of like market truths, or like, you know, stuff that's accepted in the markets. And then when you look at the data, you're like, is this really that true? Or does it really work? Absolutely. And, you know, I guess, and, you know, kind of on the trading side, you know, is there anything that, you know, you've kind of learned, or you've kind of noticed, especially, you know, Bridgewater is kind of, you know, the biggest hedge fund, versus, you know, now, you know, you're kind of focused on kind of asset allocation for more so, you know, retail investors that unlimited funds. So, you know, is there kind of a change in the approach, in terms of the way you think about investing, et cetera, you know, as you've made that transition?
Well, I think the important thing when you're thinking about being an investor too, is you're not just like a model builder, right? You have to connect what you're building to, you know, actual assets that you're going to go buy and sell. And I think, you know, there's a lot of folks who may be in the market are either so focused on the trading, the assets, that they sort of miss the bigger picture and the dynamics, et cetera. And there's others that are so focused on the bigger picture. But if you were like, okay, so like, go, like, what are you going to trade? You know, like, literally, how are you going to go get that done? You know, that becomes more of a, you know, that becomes a challenge. And so, you know, I think one of the, you know, at Bridgewater, most of my work was around developing investment strategy, though I was responsible sort of end to end in terms of all the way down to the execution. But I think this has been actually really, my work at Unlimited has been really fun, because it really has been, you know, a set of work that started with, you know, modeling and intuition and understanding, and then then picking the right tools to basically apply to the question at hand, which are, you know, maybe different from what I was doing before, you know, related, but the actual techniques a little bit different from what I was doing before, all the way down to then, okay, let's figure out the trade execution and execute it, and then put it in an ETF wrapper, and then, you know, like, okay, now we've gotten, you know, we've done the whole gamut. Yeah. And then, of course, all around the fact that I'm trying to basically take, you know, what the hedge fund industry is doing, and then, you know, reverse engineer how they're positioned and fast follow it. And so that, you know, it's been frankly a fun problem, like, you know, a different set of problems or challenges than developing proprietary investment strategy, but one that I think in a lot of ways has been pretty refreshing to me, because it's taken all of this experience and understanding that I developed over 20 years, and it's almost like take all of that and kind of reorganize it in a different way that, you know, creates, you know, that can create a beneficial financial product.
Got it. No, that's absolutely key. And I think, you know, what you said at the start is very important, because, you know, you see a lot of that, especially on Twitter, you know, where you have kind of a statement, and then you're kind of like, okay, so what is the trade? And you're like, you know, how do I incorporate an investment? Or, you know, for example, you would have someone come in with, you know, China is, I don't know, or, you know, China, the Chinese economy is collapsing, or, you know, AI is going to be big. And, you know, these kind of very, very abstract statements that don't directly have, you know, a trade that's in, you know, that's inferred, or, you know, a trade that's implicit. And so you kind of have to go from there in order to actually, you know, try and figure out, okay, you know, should I sell the Chinese yuan? You know, should I, you know, sell Chinese stocks? You know, what is the trade here? And so I think that's very, very important. I think that's very interesting that you mentioned that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's part of it's honestly when I'm writing on Twitter, I try my best to basically go through that process of connecting it to what the heck I would trade. So, you know, yeah. You can read this like long drawn out thread, which, you know, only a small share of people get all the way down to the bottom of. And, you know, and it's like what I'm trying to do in most of those instances is then connect it to, okay, well then literally, you know, what is the asset? What am I going to, you know, what makes sense? What's mispriced in the world? And I think that, you know, in a lot of ways is a really important, that method, let's say, I think is a really important process. If you just go back to sort of lessons learned in the first 20 years of my career that I don't think necessarily every investor has in their mind, which is start with what's priced in. Think then about what's happening right now and how we got there. Then think about what are the things, the couple of things, you don't need everything under the sun. What are the couple of things that are going to change the today in the future? And then compare that future to what's priced into the market to see whether or not there's an investment opportunity, right? But you got to do sort of all of those pieces. You have to make sure that you hold yourself accountable to what's priced in and you understand that. You have to understand how we got to where we are today. You have to think about what's likely to change in the future. And then you have to see that opportunity of the diff between the two. And that process is the process that creates trades.
Yeah.
Right. The process that creates trades is going through step by step in there. And the outcome is, and therefore this asset, or this reality essentially that's priced into asset markets, is inconsistent with the probabilistic reality that I think is likely to transpire.
Exactly. Absolutely. I think you're 100% spot on. And I guess, you know, moving on just to kind of the macro environment, you know, you spent quite a bit of time, you know, talking about tight labor markets and, you know, how this kind of matters to inflation. And One thing that's interesting is, you know, so recently Matt Klein, who writes The Overshoot, he came out with a piece on kind of, is it just wage growth that needs to normalize for inflation to come down? And so, you know, the rate of growth in wages has kind of been upward sloping over kind of the last, say, 18 months. And so is that kind of the key variable here, where, you know, you could have a tight labor supply, but at the same time, you know, if wages start to come down, or if wage growth starts to normalize quite a bit, you know, we would start to see inflation come down. Is that kind of the way you're thinking about it? Or, you know, what are kind of your thoughts on inflation and the labor market here?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, when you're thinking about inflation, there's basically there's two things that matter probably more than anything. Again, just going to like this, like break it down into some simple, like, digestible, understandable pieces. You know, inflation is basically oil, which permeates everything that goes on in the economy. And then the other piece is essentially how much money people are earning relative to how much they're producing. Right. Because you think about oil as sort of an inelastic input. Oil comes in, you got to pay for it because you need the energy. And when I say oil, what I mean is, like, you could kind of think more broadly about commodities weighted by the needed demand for the economy or whatever. And so you kind of think about it that way. And when it comes to wages, I describe it in that context of nominal wage growth relative to productivity growth, because I think that's a really important way to think about it. Because what that helps you understand is how much are people's pay getting increased on a, you know, on an annual basis relative to how much more are they producing. And so if, you know, I think the UK is a good example where wages are growing at almost 8% nominally per year, and then you turn over and you look at productivity, and you're like, well, the productivity is zero. Okay, yeah. Well, so how does that resolve itself? Like, you know, you can't just have more income into the system and no more stuff and expect prices to be the same. Now, of course, part of that excess income relative to productivity growth could flow into financial assets. It could meet or could resolve in greater financial savings, right? And then support financial asset prices. But particularly as you think about that sort of equation for a lower income cohort, right? Those that are primarily not saving meaningful portions of their income, like basically what happens is they earn an income and they spend it, right? And so yeah. If you can understand that imbalance between the growth and what they're getting paid and the income that they're and the income or and the amount that they're producing, that essentially gives you an indication of what structural inflationary pressures exist in the economy. And this isn't a black and white idea. You know, it's not, and there's all sorts of measurement, you know, ambiguity. So let's not like try and overdo it. But I think this basic idea right now, which is like, look, people's pay is rising pretty fast, you know, faster than it has in a long time. And the efficiency with which people are producing, you know, goods and services is weak relative to history. And so it's not surprising that we're getting this structural inflationary pressure. How does that get resolved? Well, it can get resolved through either productivity improving, which, you know, on a structural basis doesn't really change very fast. Like, I mean, even the advent of the personal computer, which is probably the biggest, you know, productivity impulse in the last 50 years, it took kind of like 15 years to matter, you know, to be, you know, meaningful, right? So that's probably not, you know, it's not going to change in the short term. But what can change, or say structural productivity doesn't change in the short term. What can change is basically two things. You can loosen the labor market, which causes wages typically to moderate, right? Because mm-hmm. as labor markets loosen, people's wage income you'd expect to slow. The other thing you can do, which is, you know, important and basically how this gets resolved in most cycles, is a loosening of the labor market typically enhances productivity. And the reason why that is that the people who are hired at last in the cycle and the people who are fired first in the cycle are typically the lowest productivity employees. And that makes sense, right? You try and find the best employees that you can to start. Yeah. And then over time you find whoever you can who's still unemployed to come into the labor market. And so that sort of tactically is how, or I'd say cyclically, is how this imbalance gets resolved. And so that's the most likely resolution here, is that, you know, there'll be sufficient slowing of economic activity that will create a moderation in the labor markets that will both improve productivity and also bring wages down. And so that's how it gets resolved.
Got it. And I think it's interesting because when you talk about, wages versus productivity. And so, you know, you want, you know, for a unit increase in wages, you know, you want to see a similar increase in productivity, you know, in which case it actually makes sense for wages to go up. And so, you know, if you look at it, you know, theoretically, if you look at what central banks are trying to do, you know, at some point or in some way, you know, they want to see the unemployment rate, you know, tick a little bit higher, just to make sure that, you know, just to keep the labor market in check. And, you know, if you look at, you know, what would happen, I guess, theoretically, it would be someone who gets unemployed, their productivity would go to zero since they don't have a job, but then, you know, they still have to pay rent, they still have to pay for food, et cetera. And so there's still some amount of spending. So, you know, theoretically, you know, there's going to be some amount of spending with no productivity. And that should, again, in theory, be inflationary. But then, you know, when you look at the relationship between, unemployment and inflation, you know, there's no real clear relationship. And, you know, that's something we observed over the 2010s where, you sort of saw many claims of the Phillips curve is dead come out. And so I guess through your work, you know, what's kind of your take on, you know, the Phillips curve or your take on this relationship between unemployment and inflation and, you know, kind of this higher rate cycle? You know, how do you think this ends?
Well, I think academic economists really want some like elegantly fine-grained theory that is then represented in a precise econometric model. And like, long ago, I gave up that is a solution to most of the types of dynamics that we see in the macro economy. And so I think the interesting thing about say something like the Phillips curve is people will sit there and say, well, you know, it's not playing out precisely as it has in other cycles or whatever. And it's like, yep, totally right. Look at the empirical evidence. It's relatively clear. But that doesn't mean the fundamental cause effect linkage isn't basically the same. Again, going back to that concept of fundamentals, like if the labor market loosens, the pressure on wages will ease.
Yeah.
Like that is a fundamental concept. Now, what makes this business more challenging than writing, you know, econometric papers is that there's a lot of ambiguity, other things, a lot of things going on at the same time. And so you can't just say, okay, well, I'm just going to use the curve from before and, you know, apply the curve to today. And I think even today's like dynamics, like if you thought about employment tightness as a more, you know, in a more comprehensive way, right? I think what you'd say is that there has been a meaningful loosening of employment tightness, today relative to where it was, you know, 18 or 24 months ago, right? And so, so if you get too hung up on measured unemployment, it will look like the relationship doesn't hold. But if you look at like, you know, I mean, here's a simple example, like, you know, is there such a demand for engineers that they're getting paid, you know, $300,000 bonuses in order to come on? No. Okay. Well, like that's indicative of the fact that the labor market has softened a little bit, right? And that also connects to the fact that, you know, income has moderated a little bit. So I think don't give up on the fundamentals. Think about it less precisely and more comprehensively. And I think you'll find these sort of core intuitions to still be quite viable. It's just, it's not viable in the way that, you know, an econometric paper points them out.
Got it. And you know, I've also seen you, and you know, you've also kind of talked about how central banks across the world, and you know, the BOC, the BOE, you know, the Fed, the ECB, etc., they've kind of taken this big bet on where they've hiked rates at the fast rate possible. And what they're trying to do is, you know, moderate inflation and, you know, try and weaken the labor market. And so, you know, if you were, you know, the governor of the Fed or the governor of, you know, a central bank, you know, what would be your approach to kind of solving the inflation problem that we're seeing right now? Because, you know, as you've talked about, you know, it's not exactly black and white where, you know, you see, you know, inflation, therefore, you know, we hike interest rates and therefore inflation comes down. And it's just not been that way. And it's taken a lot longer for inflation to resolve than what most people have been expecting.
Yeah, first of all, I'd say, you know, central banks face a pretty challenging circumstance right now because in a lot of ways, the restructuring of economies following the financial crisis have really sort of changed their toolkit and the effectiveness of their toolkit in terms of, you know, rate rises and even asset price moves to shifts in demand and, you know, nominal incomes and with it nominal spending and inflation. And so they're positioned, or the structurally, like we haven't seen a real down cycle in 15 years because COVID was kind of like, you know, a little bit of, you know, it was an external shock more than it was a cycle, right? It wasn't really the cycle. It was a crisis, a sort of shock situation. And so given it's been 15 years and given the entire economy has basically been restructured since COVID or since the GFC, that uncertainty means that, you know, they don't really necessarily know exactly what they need to do to achieve their goals, right? And I think often people will say, well, I think maybe they're just not achieving, you know, they've given up on their goals, or, you know, the Fed is, you know, fine with higher inflation and there's some sort of, you know, conspiratorial view that, you know, central bankers are trying to like structurally inflate away the debt and fund the government and stuff like that. I don't think that that's right. Like, this is more a story of, you know, that would suggest that there was planfulness, there was a design for the challenging outcomes that they've seen. And I think it's more a matter of incompetence, not judgmental incompetence, just like they have not been competent to be able to achieve the goals that they've set forth. And so in that context, I think what we see a lot of these folks is they've really gone and leaned on the one lever that they feel like they know that's more, you know, been used for 40 years, which is interest rate hikes, only to find those to be like not that effective in getting done what they need to get done. And for a number of fundamental reasons why that is, in terms of, you know, restructuring debt in the economy and terming it out and fixed, you know, low fixed borrowings and mortgages and by corporations. And you know, the funny thing is that they've sort of stepped away from using a lever that actually proved pretty effective in the 2010s, not perfect, but pretty effective, which was the use of quantitative easing or tightening, you know, which is just the flip side of it. And they've kind of given up, you know, basically everyone has given up on QT as a lever. The Fed really hasn't changed its view on QT in a long time. And that's surprising to me, because when I think about, you know, the US economy is too hot, right? Inflation is too high relative to mandate. That's the basic issue. Yeah. We could quibble about the nuances of that. You know, the price of credit is not really the problem in the US economy. Like, it costs a lot to borrow. You know, they've like pretty radically changed mortgage prices, car loan prices, all that stuff. The problem is that people aren't borrowing at those elevated rates, right? Because they don't have to borrow at those elevated rates because their asset prices are so elevated that they can basically sell assets to buy the things that they want, you know, essentially pay all cash for houses or all cash for cars because asset prices are elevated. And quantitative tightening is the most effective lever to influence asset prices, right? Because all quantitative tightening is selling assets. And so the central bank sells assets, that should hurt asset prices. And it should help deal with this problem, which is really not a price of credit problem that's been repriced, but a price of assets problem that continues to keep the economy going at a level and rate that is too hot relative to the mandate.
Got it. Yeah, you know, you've kind of talked about that, the kind of disparity between, you know, the price of credit versus the price of assets. And I think that's really interesting. And, you know, I guess I wanted to use that to segue into kind of the asset allocation side. So, you know, considering, you know, over the last, you know, over the last 10 years, pretty much, you know, especially until 2021, there's been kind of a generation of investors, you know, obviously me included, who've never seen high interest rates, high inflation. All we've seen is prosperity, you know, for an extended period of time. And so, you know, all of a sudden now, you know, within the period of a few months, it's all flipped on its head, where now you have high rates, higher inflation, et cetera. And so, you know, when you think about asset allocation in this kind of an environment, how do you go about, you know, approaching that problem? You know, you came out, I think, a couple of days ago with a post on how, you know, the role of cash and how, you know, you should not be, you know, dumping into cash with rates of 5% unless, you know, you were a genius market timer, which obviously everyone's a genius market timer, right? So, so how would you approach the asset allocation problem, you know, given the environment that we're facing?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have an interesting environment where, you know, if you think about it, there's a large generation of folks who basically have only learned that, like, you know, you go YOLO highest risk asset. I mean, like, think about it. If you started investing in March of 2009, which is, you know, where the bottom of the US stock market was, like, how many months have you experienced, you know, meaningful declines in equity prices? Like, in the span of 15 years, you've experienced like probably like one collective year, right? Because like COVID reversed basically instantaneously. It's like, you know, 20 days. And, you know, 2022 felt so painful, but I mean, it was really just kind of like January to October. Like, that's not actually that long a time frame, right? And so, you know, so I think a lot of folks sit there and look at it and basically say, well, look, why would I do anything other than basically go all in on stocks? Because, that's what I've learned. And I think, you know, it's important to recognize just how unusual this environment was. You know, the massive monetary creation that we saw post financial crisis in order to create, you know, a moderately growing economy is not necessarily something that will persist forever, nor will the secular and global in nature disinflationary forces that basically existed for the last 20 or 30 years before COVID exist for forever either. And so, you know, I think for a lot of folks, the question, you know, there are a lot of folks who are still YOLO stocks and like, you know, I can't really convince them otherwise. Maybe try and show them the fact that, you know, stocks can be in real drawdowns for like 20 years. And that's happened, you know, a fair amount, but, you know, maybe you can't convince those folks. But for folks who sort of recognize that this time, this period may be different from what they experienced. I think a lot of folks' initial inclination is go to cash, right? Because cash will be a better, you know, cash, you don't have a yield penalty. It's yielding 5.5%, like not a bad deal. I think the challenge with that is that, that is a solution, but I just think it's not a great solution when you have the alternative solution of buying a well-diversified portfolio of assets to invest in. And the reason why that is like, look, cash over very short periods outperforms assets, can outperform assets as the central bank's trying to tighten aggressively. But, you know, in the vast majority of instances, financial assets outperform cash. And there's a fundamental reason why that is because why would you ever invest in financial assets if you didn't get a return above a risk-free asset like cash? And so, you know, it comes down to the fact that, you know, in general, assets outperform cash. And so you really don't want to be overweight cash because it, you know, because that will create return drag on you over time. The real question is, how do you construct your asset portfolio to make it as balanced as possible to make sure that you have some indifference, right? You're not swayed by one particular market environment. Those who are YOLO stocks, you know, basically are looking for low inflationary environments with very strong growth. And the reality is there's lots of other environments that happen: stagflation, depression, you know, you can have deflation, you know, disinflationary booms, you can have disinflationary busts, you can have all these sorts of dynamics that occur. And so much better just try and create a diversified portfolio to protect yourself against that. And I think in particular, recognizing that the real risk of ruin for investors is not bad growth. That's not a problem, right? You can buy bonds, you can buy other assets that perform well during weak growth environments. The real risk of ruin for an investor is an elevated inflationary environment when they're holding disinflation-oriented assets. That's the risk of ruin. That's what happened in the 70s and 60s for many investors, right? Created huge losses of wealth. And so that's really what people have to protect themselves against. And the funny thing is, because we've had, you know, 40 years of disinflation, it's the exact thing that people are not protecting themselves against.
Yep. No, it's absolutely true. And you know, one thing that, you know, you've touched up on is, and you know, on Twitter, you kind of see the two extremes of this. So when it comes to the role of gold in an investment portfolio, you kind of see the two extremes where, you know, you have the one camp, which is the gold bugs, where they're, you know, they're all about the 5,000 year history and how, you know, you should have 100% allocation to gold and store no vault in, you know, Switzerland. And then on the other side, you know, you have kind of the MMT guys who say, you know, gold is worthless and it's kind of a currency of the past. It's just a shiny pet rock, you know, it's got no value. And, you know, you kind of take a more sensible approach. So I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on, you know, gold and kind of, you know, what kind of role does gold play in an investment portfolio?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, gold's role, and the first thing I'd say is gold, we've gotten, you know, 5,000 years of history in terms of, you know, the role of gold, or to see and understand how gold functions as a financial asset. And I think that's an important thing because, you know, gold is different from extractive commodities, you know, which have like productive value, or stocks or bonds that have a clear, you know, have a clear reason why they would have yield over time, right? So somewhat of a fundamental valuation that can be thought of relative to the cash flows that they'll produce. You know, gold's different, of course, because it has de minimis industrial value and also offers no yield. So you put that together and that's a very interesting asset. And so you do have to understand it in the context, like, how gold works and how gold functions and performs as a financial asset is a matter of psychology. Like, that's very interesting. Like, a very interesting thing to think about, yeah, that it is a matter of psychology. Like, it's not a matter of fundamentals, it's a matter of psychology. So you have to understand the psychology, and the psychology basically holds in a couple different ways. First of all, gold serves as a contracurrency. And what I mean by that is that, you know, paper currency has a certain value, yeah, that's expected over time, and gold is a contra to that, in the sense of it is an alternative currency that you can hold your assets in, that is, you know, widely accepted in the sense of you know, everyone in the world, people buy gold in all sorts of different ways, and has been accepted throughout history. And so whenever you're thinking about gold, it's important to think about it like, I can either choose yielding paper currency, right? Or I can choose non-yielding gold. And what you see is, in times when people start to raise questions about the value of paper currency, you often see gold outperform paper currency. And the other thing is, at times when you see interest rates rise on paper currency, you typically see gold underperform.
Yep. Yep.
Right? Because one has yield and one doesn't. And that's just a natural trade-off. And so I think you want to think about it with those fundamental dynamics. And in that context, it allows you to start to think about, okay, what are the circumstances, the outlier circumstances, the unusual circumstances where you'd expect to see gold do well. And that's, you know, places where you have to have meaningful currency devaluations, like interesting in China today, just as a simple example, in an environment where there's meaningful capital controls, right? What are they doing? They're going to buy gold, and gold's trading at like an 8% premium in Shanghai over what its price is in London. You know, that's it may be a pet rock, but you know, it's a pet rock that all of humanity across cultures has largely identified as being the pet rock you want when you want to be able to store, you know, have a storehold of wealth.
Yeah.
And so that's a good example. There's also a situation where, let's say you think that there's a risk of a meaningful easing of monetary policy, an unreasonable easing of monetary policy, let's say, because, you know, let's say central banks haven't beaten back the inflation dynamic, even though they're starting to shift their interest rate policy. That could be a good time for gold, because it's a circumstance where the value of paper money versus stuff is starting to get depreciated. And you see a circumstance where yields are starting to compress. Those two things set themselves up for actually quite a good circumstance for gold. And so you want to think about it from those fundamental perspectives. And I think what you'll find if you look through time is that gold is a pretty good diversifying asset in a lot of circumstances. You know, as a simple example, if you go back and look through time in terms of like rolling 12-month periods where U.S. equities have been down over the last 75 years, gold has outperformed bonds in more than 50% of those circumstances.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, like, it, you know, and then you just compare that and you just say, well, that's empirical evidence. And I could go show that to you across developed countries. I could show you across emerging countries. It's a little better for emerging countries because of the contra currency stuff. But you put that all together and then you say, okay, so how much gold do you have in your portfolio? And someone's like, no, none, because you'd be a crazy person to hold gold, because only weirdos hold gold. And I'm sitting there going like, what? Like, you know, I'm no, you know, living in a bunker gold bug. I'm just looking at the empirical evidence and I'm like, well, you know, this seems about as good as a diversifier as bonds are. So like, maybe I should just kind of hold them in an equal weight. But yet that's like a radical difference. Like everyone in the world is overweight bonds and basically no one holds gold. Even though the empirical evidence would suggest that there's like very good reason why you'd want to hold gold, over long time frames.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And it's kind of like gold plays the role of insurance in your portfolio, especially as a retail investor. You know, you kind of have access to gold and, you know, as you mentioned, it's kind of the contra currency. It does well in times of distress, and when there aren't times of distress, you know, as you mentioned, you should have you have that trade off between, you know, a non yielding asset versus, you know, right now where you see cash yielding say 5%, and so that becomes a very obvious trade off that, you know, you get to think about.
And it works out that, you know, if you first of all, I always like to ask the question, like, you know, what assets perform better, you know, let's say since 2000, gold or stocks? The answer is gold. What assets performs better in, you know, since 2010, gold or stocks? Well, actually, you know, it's gold. You know, like how many of these things do you have to how many times do you have to, you know, over all these time frames, what about since the beginning of the tightening cycle, like gold or bonds? Oh, actually, you know, gold has meaningfully outperformed bonds since January 2022. Like, what about since the beginning of the year? Like, just like go through all of these different circumstances. And what you see is like, frankly, there's some like bizarre blockage, right? In terms of people's thinking about the value of gold and the role of gold in a portfolio, that like, just open your mind to the empirical evidence that gold could be a beneficial asset to your portfolio. And I'm not saying go invest, you know, all your money, you know, in bars in the Perth Mint or something like that. I'm saying like, buy, you know, put 10% of your portfolio in gold. Like you'll likely be happy for it. Yeah. You know, that's not a bit, you know, and you get most of the diversification benefit from just that 10% allocation.
Yeah, no, exactly. And yeah. And, you know, as you mentioned, yeah, you know, don't buy 100% gold and then, you know, go live in a bunker in, you know, Northern Canada.
Or maybe you want to, but it, you know, should have nothing to do with your asset allocation preference and more for your desired preference to interact with other people.
Or not interact with other people.
That's right.
Yep, absolutely. And I wanted to move and, you know, talk a bit about kind of the hedge fund landscape and say, you know, another thing that, you know, you've been pretty vocal about is, you know, and, you know, I quote, you know, one of your tweets where you say, you know, managers' track record built during a period of zero interest rates with much smaller AUM is unlikely to be indicative of performance during a period of elevated rates and much larger AUM. And, you know, you've kind of also, you know, highlighted kind of the dispersion where, you know, you know, for example, in 2022, a lot of, you know, macro strategies did very, very well. And then in 2023, you know, they're not doing as well. And, you know, over kind of the 2010s, you know, they were kind of so-and-so, you know, some of them did well, some of them did not do too well. And, you know, you kind of have this big dispersion, in returns, especially on the public market side. And so, you know, kind of the hedge fund industry, you know, say in the 1990s, which was where, you know, you could have, you know, two guys in a basement with the Bloomberg terminal and, you know, you could run a hedge fund that way. And, you know, it's kind of evolved into where, you know, now you have the giants, you know, you have the Millenniums, the Bridgewaters, the Brevan Howards, et cetera. And with almost, you know, and, you know, the smaller funds, you know, they tend to suffer. So, you know, the hedge fund industry has kind of evolved. And so, you know, well, you know, what are your thoughts on that? And, you know, kind of how, you know, how it's changed, how it's evolved, and, you know, where that kind of alternative investment industry is headed from here.
Well, I think, you know, there's in some ways, the industry has changed a lot in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years, certainly since I started getting involved in it. And in some ways, it hasn't changed that much. And the reason why I say that is that, you know, the big picture is that that fund managers almost always sort of have a set of a strategy, right? An alpha edge of some form. And that's all really the strategy is a way to gain, you know, durable alpha edge. Yeah. And that what they're trying to do is come in and day in and day out, like execute that strategy in the most, you know, disciplined, effective way possible to get the most out of their edge. And the nature of these strategies, which I'll call alphas, you know, they're all different, slightly different, but that, you know, they're kind of knowable in the sense of, if you, for instance, were to look at the index of, you know, the average manager return or the median manager return, what you see is that those alphas, those strategies have certain properties. There are certain ones of those alphas that, you know, do better in early cycle environments and some better in late cycle environments, or certain ones that are better in, you know, monetary easing environments and others in monetary tightening or elevating volatility and falling volatility. Because in a lot of ways, those strategies are just they're ways to reap the benefits of irrational behavior by other folks in the market, and that irrationality emerges at different points under different conditions. And I think one of the challenges, there's really two challenges that exist in the hedge fund space for any investor, which is, you know, the first is the single manager problem, which is, well, I've sort of described that there are these hedge fund strategies and they have alphas and those alphas have properties. The reality is any individual manager is like kind of taking that core idea and then adding their own flavor on it, which, to be frank, mostly adds randomness, right? That in general, managers don't show actually much outperformance persistence. Like the likelihood that a manager outperforms over the span of 5 years is above median over the, you know, each of a 5 years is equivalent to randomly selecting managers, right? So, you know, it's, there really isn't that much manager performance persistence. And so sort of that incremental alpha, individual manager alpha relative to the strategy alpha isn't that good. And so you're kind of better off actually looking at the strategy alphas, not the individual manager alphas, if you're trying to think about how do you do that in the most efficient way possible. The other thing that I'd say is that allocators are stuck with this, basically this core problem of a lack of agility, right? So if you're an allocator and you go invest in a fund, like what are the odds that you redeem that fund, you know, in a month or 2 months or 3 months or 5 years or 10 years, right? I mean, the decision-making process around the allocation of these funds is incredibly slow moving. And so I think what that does is it means that there are certain strategies, going back to what I just said before, there are certain strategies you almost know are not going to go well during a period of time, right? You're like, oh, well, you know, I bet my equity long short managers are going to get really squeezed right now during this period of rising equity volatility. Absolutely. And then like, what do you do? Well, I don't know. You like go home and have a beer and hope that it's okay, you know, because you can't agilely move between the different strategies. And so that kind of stuck situation means that, you know, from an allocator's perspective, there's not really much benefit from trying to pick which strategies can outperform which other one, because you know you're just going to get stuck in essentially all the strategies at some point. And so you know I think those are sort of the two core issues that we haven't been able as an industry really to meaningfully overcome those core issues, which is get away from individual managers because there's too much randomness relative to value, and get away from, you know, basically totally illiquid structural positions that force you to be in stuff that you'd prefer not to be. Very different from equity investing or bond investing, where you know there's indexes all over the place and where you can be highly agile in how you allocate your capital.
Absolutely. And you know, on that note of agility, you know, I'm sitting here in Toronto, kind of the home of the Ontario Teachers and the Canada Pension Plans, kind of the large some of the large institutional investors. And what I've noticed is, you know, with these large institutional investors, they've kind of shifted to kind of slimming down, you know, their exposure to public markets and sort of shifted over to being more exposed to private markets, where, you know, you get to kind of hide your true risk adjusted returns, you know, below years of illiquidity and return smoothing, where that's kind of notable because in the private equity and, you know, the private side is, you know, typically depended on 40 years of, you know, lower rates year after year after year, and, you know, debt that's borrowed on those lower rates. And now that, you know, over the last 18 to 24 months, we've observed interest rates go up, you know, they're kind of in a pickle right now. So I guess, you know, on that note, you know, do you have any thoughts on kind of, you know, this emergence of, you know, kind of the liquid private side, and how, you know, institutions have kind of, you know, shifted towards or have been more biased towards the private side?
Well, the first thing I can confidently say is that the emergence of these private fund strategies have made the managers rich.
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And then you think about that and you say, well, if the managers are rich, who's getting poorer? And the answer is the investors are getting poorer. And the reason why that is, the investors are worse off as a function of these strategies. And the reason why that is that the private fund managers are essentially offering a return smoothing vehicle, sometimes with leverage, sometimes with just higher volatility. And what they're doing is they're charging, you know, 700 basis points a year in effective costs to do it. Well, you know, that is a pretty odd approach if you're an asset manager, if you're an allocator, right? Because you can choose to smooth your returns however the heck you want, right? You don't have to, you know, book your S&P 500 exposure on a day-to-day basis. There's no reason why that has to be the case, right? You could book it over a quarter or a year, or you could even think about it for, I mean, a lot of these institutional investors, like they're not thinking, their time horizons are 50 or 100 years. Like why even, you know, you could book it over 10 years, right? What's going on with that? But instead they're being fooled by the package, right? And thinking that package is beneficial. And the reality is it's at the detriment of their stakeholders, the huge detriment to their stakeholders. I think the thing that's interesting is if you, for instance, take, let's say instead of looking at, you know, venture capital returns on a quarterly basis, which is a silly way to look at it, of course, because you can't get your money out on a quarterly basis, right? You give your money and you get your, and you get some payments over the course of, you know, between 5 and 15 years, right? Yeah. So if instead you were to account for it on a, let's say a 10-year average, let's just say, like you just said, I 10-year smooth my 60-40 portfolio and I 10-year smooth my venture capital returns, right? Which is essentially how it works out. What you'd find is that venture capital outcomes are actually a net drag on the Sharpe ratio of portfolios. Right. When you actually do the proper accounting matching, right, they're a net drag on the portfolios. And the core reason why that is because of the fees, because they're charging such egregious fees for what they're doing to give you returns that, you know, basically you could have gotten otherwise in lots of other different ways. And so I think that's at the core. You know, that's fine. Like if someone wants to return smooth or whatever, like, you know, no grudge against them. That's not the problem that I have with it. The problem I have it with it is that, you know, the managers are getting rich off the backs of, you know, the teacher's pension.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And, you know, that's something, you know, you've worked to democratize that unlimited funds. And so, you know, I wanted to wrap the podcast on kind of that note. You know, could you tell our listeners, you know, who may not know what Unlimited does, you know, could you talk a bit about, you know, what the mission is there and, you know, what you guys are doing? Cause you know, it's very, very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, one of the thoughts or the basic, you know, idea that I had having sort of sat in the manager seat of the 2 and 20 world, for almost 20 years was basically like, look, 2 and 20 businesses are great for the manager and not that great for the investor. And the reason why that is 2 and 20 businesses are pretty good at generating returns and they're also pretty good at charging high fees. And you put those two things together and, you know, that's not a great outcome for the investor. And so, you know, that kind of got me to thinking about whether there was a way to sort of bring those concepts of low cost indexing and access that obviously have totally changed stock and bond investing. I mean, just radically changed stock and bond investing over the last 50 years. Could we do the same sort of thing in the world of 2 and 20? And you know, that at its core is what we're trying to do at Unlimited is basically use technology plus our decades of experience having, you know, built a lot of these 2 and 20 strategies or you know, invested from that perspective to basically find, you know, combinations of public market securities to do a pretty good job of tracking what those sort of managers are doing or sort of the return producing. And then of course, because, you know, we're using technology and instead of like having to actually hire all the people to go out and do the deals or, you know, actually create proprietary strategies, then we can offer it at just a much, much lower fee structure. So that's kind of the idea. Is you know, these technology enabled approaches to create index replications of 2 and 20 strategies.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Awesome. With that, Bob, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was amazing to have you on, man.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was great to chat. Hopefully folks find it interesting.
Absolutely.
Probably the private equity folks won't, but you know, there you go.
Thank you for listening to Market Champions. To never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe, and we'll see you next time.